Welcome to Legal Talk, a monthly conversation about the American legal system with Minnesota Supreme Court Associate Justice Gordon Moore.
Good morning, Justice Moore. How are you doing today?
Morning, Rich. Big news down here at the stations. Congratulations.
Well, thank you very kindly. We do appreciate that. Yeah, there's a lot going on here the next few months, and boy, we are sure going to miss our friend Jeff Johnson, but we're super happy for him, too.
I'm happy for Jeff and very happy for the community that you're stepping into the roles of owning this institution and keeping it going.
I appreciate that. And that's the whole goal right there, is just to keep it going for the community. Anyway, you're all dressed up today. You've even got your Carlton Colors tie on. It kind of looks like you have to go to work after we're done.
Yeah,
here today.
Yep. We've got a lot to do with Justice Anderson leaving the court. On May 10th, we have a crunch time now, about three and a half weeks, where we have a ton of stuff that has to get done. Because any case where he is writing, either the majority or the dissent has to be published by that date. And any case where we are maybe 4-3 and his vote is, decisive, has to be resolved by then. And so, it feels like this is kind of how July sometimes feels, right at the end of the term, where we're trying to get stuff done before the clerks leave. And this is an intense period. So, we've got lots of work to do, but had to stop by the station on the way up to St. Paul to chat about legal issues.
Well, we do appreciate you giving us some time. What's been going on with the courts in the last month since we last spoke?
Well, we're almost finished with April. We do have one interesting case, though, that's left, and that was added to the calendar. That'll be heard tomorrow. That is legal marijuana now versus Simon. That is the challenge that the DFL party has made to the continuation of legal marijuana now as a major party under Minnesota law. They qualified, the legal LMN, as we call them, has existed for 26 years. They qualified for major party status in 2018 when its state auditor candidate got over 5% of the vote. That was the threshold in the statewide election. And there is a petition under the state's election laws that's been brought by another party, the DFL party, to remove the legal marijuana now party from the major party status. And so that case is being argued tomorrow, and I'm not going to say a lot more about it because obviously it's a pending matter, and I'm not expressing any opinion on it other than that it's an interesting case. It raises some very interesting questions about, essentially who controls how party operates, political parties. Is it the parties themselves, or can the state legislature control that by their laws?
I have not paid much attention to that case at all, except I knew it was out there, and it makes a person scratch their head, because marijuana is now legal in Minnesota, so why would we need that political party? But you're not going to talk about this at all.
No.
But I'm sure there's other agenda items on that party's platform.
Oh, I'm sure they would say so. I haven't reviewed the platform. We had two marijuana parties that were major parties, and they had to meet certain criteria by a certain period of time. That's being heard tomorrow. And then we have a little bit of break before the May cases start, but the May sitting actually starts in April because of how the calendar falls on the 29th of April. So it's going to be again, crunch time, because in addition to getting the work done that I referenced earlier regarding opinions that Justice Anderson is involved with, we have 10 new cases for May, two attorney discipline, one workers' comp, one tax appeal, and 6 petitions for review. And one of those cases is going to be heard at a high school. Our traveling oral argument is going to Mora High School. They've got a brand new high school up in Mora, which is in the 10th district. Not really a metro vicinity, but the spring traveling arguments typically go to a metro courthouse. And so Mora's on the outer edges of the 10th district. They've never had a court argument, and they're very proud of their new school. I've seen photos of it. It's fantastic. I know the judge up there. They're very proud of it. And so, we're going up there for the last case on the May calendar. So that's going to be important. And then obviously the other unresolved business with the court is the decision the governor has to make regarding filling the vacancies of Justice Anderson, which will occur with his retirement on the 10th of May, and then Justice Margaret Chudik, who will retire at the end of the court's term on July 31st. And so starting in August, for sure, we'll have two new members of the court. Yeah.
And the governor's office did put out the list of finalists, at least, that they're looking at.
Yes.
And it's an interesting list. It's And they're interviewing those people right now, as I understand it.
The interview process is occurring. I know the governor's office wants to have appointments announced by the end of the month. Timing here is a little bit crunched because of the legislative sessions going on. I mean, there's a lot of different things happening. But yes, six finalists, three judges, three practicing attorneys, all capable, distinguished, qualified people, vastly different experiences and backgrounds, which is good. The governor's office, with the assistance of the Judicial Selection Commission, took, I think, 31 applications and interviewed 12 or 13, and now they've got this list of six. They're excellent names. I know a number of them personally. I don't know a few of the others, but I'm pleased to see that the people that are on this list are all people who are, very, very qualified and able to be on the court.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to throw you a little bit of a curveball this morning because something just occurred to me while we were talking, and I'm not sure we've ever talked about it. You've got 10 new cases coming up in May. Have we ever discussed how the court decides what cases it's going to hear?
Well, I think we've talked about it a little bit, but maybe it's time, in a future episode, we could go into that a little bit more details. Most of them are from the Court of Appeals on what we call petitions for review, where the parties want us to review a decision the Court of Appeals made.
Right.
Basically, somebody's unhappy. Sometimes both parties are unhappy, and they want us to say something about that. Most petitions for review are not granted. This Court of Appeals becomes the final say on a lot of cases. But the Court of Appeals decisions, some of them are characterized as precedential, meaning that they actually do have impact beyond the case and can be cited by judges and attorneys. But the vast majority of them are considered non-precedential. They're limited to the facts of the case. They don't establish any sweeping broad principles. And sometimes the Court of Appeals issues a decision on a really important issue that the Supreme Court hasn't looked at, that has statewide significance or involves the constitutionality of a statute. And the court feels like, hey, this is something important and the Supreme Court should be the last word on this. Sometimes somebody just has to say what the rule is. Sometimes there's not a real clear-cut right answer, and somebody just has to draw a line and say, this is what we're saying. And that role is, I think, most appropriate for the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
We do hear direct appeals from tax court and workers' compensation court of appeals. Those come to us on what's called a writ of certiorari. It's a totally different process. Sometimes we hear oral arguments on those cases. Sometimes we don't, depending on how complex the issues are. But we don't have any discretion of those. They come to us. If the lawyers want us to review them, we will.
Okay.
We do first-degree murder appeals, direct appeals.
Automatically to you.
Yeah, they bypass the Court of Appeals, and we've had a number of those this year. That would be, if I was characterizing a theme for the 23-24 term, it would be lots of first-degree murder appeals. We've had a bunch of them.
First-degree murder is being able to get a first-degree murder charge it's difficult. That's interesting that you've got so many of them.
Generally intentional, premeditated murder of another person. And some of it may have been a bit of a backlog due to pandemic cases working their way through the process.
Yep.
And some of them are really complex, involving post-conviction relief petitions that have been filed after the conviction but before a direct appeal has existed. So sometimes we consolidate those. They involve the same case but somewhat different issues. They take a lot of time because the records on those cases are very factually intensive. Sometimes they rise or fall on very discrete facts.
Right.
So in that case, the Supreme Court is acting a little bit like the Court of Appeals. We are acting as an error correction court in addition to a precedential court. So, Yeah, we could talk more about that, Rich, at a later episode.
Yeah, I think there
are particular criteria for that. So that's those are kind of the big issues that are bubbling up with the mm-hmm. Supreme Court right now. Mm-hmm. With our court, we're going to be a court of five on a few cases here because of recusals and justices not participating.
Wow.
And so it's going to feel a little different.
Here. Yeah.
typically justices don't get a case in their last month on the court because obviously they have to clean up what they've got. They don't have the time to get new stuff.
Which means Justice Anderson then is essentially finished. Well, except for he's cleaning up all the stuff he's.
Yeah, the chief, if you look at the U.S. Men Court's Instagram account, there was a clip of the tribute that Chief Justice Hudson delivered to Justice Anderson at the end of his last full oral argument with the court last week. Tomorrow, he will participate tomorrow with this illegal marijuana now case.
Okay.
But that will be with a five-member court because of two recusals. So that was his last hurrah with the full court, and Chief Justice Natalie Hudson delivered a really nice tribute to him. I encourage people to listen to that on the Min Court's Instagram page if you can access that. He sat in May essentially to break ties. He did not have a case assigned to him. He was there to participate, mm-hmm. vote, and break ties. And now it's a question of getting his work out. And then he is sitting on May 10th. The last day of his service will be the attorney admission ceremony for June. And he'll deliver remarks on behalf of the court, which has been a very important part of his work for the court, the work with the Board of Law Examiners and the admission ceremony. Under Justice Anderson's leadership, that was brought back from either Roy Wilkins Auditorium or O'Shaughnessy Auditorium at St. Kate's or St. Thomas. I don't remember which one it was when I was admitted, but it used to have a very institutional sort of cattle call feel to it. You know, 1,000 people in an auditorium, stand up, take the oath, you're done, congratulations. Mm-hmm. This is really a nice alternative to that. Students come in groups that are manageable, and their families get to come in.
Nice.
We've done this in the House of Representatives chambers, thanks to the permission of both leaders from both parties have allowed us to do that and to use that space. The May 10th ceremony is a little smaller because the spring, the number of people taking the bar in the spring is fewer. So it'll be actually in the Capitol courtroom, but they come in groups, and they're able to be acknowledged in a way that I think is really important. So, Justice Anderson will be participating on that day, and we will have a special release day for opinions that have to be issued that day. So stay tuned for that. Normally they're on Wednesdays only, but because of the amount of work that we have to get done, some of it's going to be right up to the edge.
Okay.
So that's our court. There's some other interesting things going on in world of law. Two things that I thought listeners might want to think about or consider. The first is an argument that the United States Supreme Court is hearing tomorrow to determine basically whether people involved in the January 6th riot at the Capitol can be convicted under a federal statute for obstructing or impeding an official proceeding.
Hmm.
And the argument that the prosecution makes is that the joint session of Congress, which convened on January 6th to formally certify Biden's victory, was that proceeding. However, the obstruction law that's being used was passed after the Enron fiasco. For those of us who have been around long enough, there was an exposure of fraud, shredding of documents during the collapse of the energy giant Enron. And mm-hmm. so the legislature passed a statute in 2002. Actually, it was an amended part of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, which followed the Enron scandal. And so the law prohibits people who corruptly alter, destroy, mutilate, or conceal a record, document, or other object, or attempt to do so with the intent to impair the object's integrity or availability for use in an official proceeding, or otherwise obstructs, influences, or impedes any official proceeding or attempts to do so. And so the question is, are those two clauses of the statute intertwined, or are they separate? the government relies on the second clause as a catch-all proceeding, and with the word otherwise. So otherwise obstructs, influences, or impedes any official proceeding.
Right.
That isn't seemingly limited to just, you know, Enron type scenarios,
right,
where people are, you know, shredding documents to avoid being prosecuted or avoid a subpoena. So the government says you don't have to read those two clauses together. The defendants are saying, hold on a second here. There was a reason Congress passed this law, and it was only to deter or prohibit tampering or destroying official records or documents. And so the question is, does the expansive language in the second clause address the concern? Is it limited only to the concerns in the first clause? And that's what is really important, because, Rich, there have been over 100 people convicted of this crime as part of the federal government's January 6th prosecutions.
Yeah.
100 rioters have been sentenced and convicted under this statute. And basically, the defense bar is saying prosecutors have overreached by charging rioters with a crime that's really limited to tampering or destroying evidence sought by investigators. And so the this decision could have an impact on the prosecution of the former president in the federal court case involving his alleged role in the J6 matter. Now, I'm not going to express any opinion regarding any of this. But I'm just teeing this up because I think this is a really important argument that's occurring. And I will say that the Supreme Court over the past 5-10 years has really, constricted the ability of the federal government to use statutes in a broad manner to prosecute people. I mean, they've basically accused the federal government of overreach in a number of cases. And so the question will be, did that happen here? It's worth noting that all but one of the 15 judges that have handled those cases at the trial court level have sided with the government.
Okay.
One judge, however, did rule that the otherwise clause refers only to the efforts to tamper or destroy records or documents. So stay tuned. That'll be argued tomorrow in Washington.
I have two questions about that. First of all, it would seem to me that what you're looking at there is the definition of official proceeding. Wouldn't it? I mean, because what with Enron, what we're talking about is an investigation.
Right.
But what was interrupted by those rioters was the ratification of the election, which would seem to me, you know, by any definition, would be an official federal proceeding.
Yeah, this is where principles of statutory interpretation come into play. Courts over the past 25 years have become very textualist, very much focused on reading the text, plain meaning, you know, not looking at kind of public policy arguments or making assumptions about what the legislature might have thought or did thought. The question is that language ambiguous?
Mm-hmm.
If it's not ambiguous, the textualist approach to deciding statutory interpretation questions says, we look at the text, we figure out what the text means, and we apply the plain language of the text, even if it results in an outcome that, you know, maybe we don't think is the greatest. We're just applying what Congress wrote, and if Congress wants to change it, they could. If the law is deemed to be ambiguous, in other words, if there are two reasonable interpretations of that, then the law allows the justices to get into what we call canons of statutory interpretation that allow things like legislative history, the purpose to be obtained, the mischief to be remedied, you know, some of those broader concerns to be brought in. And I think there is an argument for ambiguity here. I don't know how strong of an argument. Mm-hmm. I haven't delved into this or read the briefs and gotten into the nitty-gritty analysis, but the fact that that case is before the Supreme Court suggests that there are a number of justices on the court that have some concerns about how that law was being applied.
Interesting.
And so, yeah, stay tuned. That will be one of the June cases that will be released.
Am I interpreting this right in that this could actually free the people who have been convicted, who are still in prison, and possibly even expunge their records?
You know, Rich, the breadth of that, well, it depends entirely on what the decision is.
Yeah.
But the answer is potentially yes. I mean, now many of those folks were convicted of misdemeanors for you know, entering a building without permission. But the felony charges are, you know, that was the big, you know, felony charge here that was used for a lot of these people. If you couldn't prove sedition or conspiracy to, you know, to basically
overthrow
the government, you could prove that they were involved in this effort, this alleged effort to obstruct, influence, or impede the proceeding by the acts of going in there. And so it has, as we say, downstream implications, serious downstream implications. And I believe two of the charges against the former president are hinging on this interpretation here. Not the entire case, but so just stay tuned. Obviously, the other news regarding the former president is his trial starting today. Last I heard, when I last checked 45 minutes ago or so, lawyers were convening in court in Manhattan to determine whether the alleged doctoring of financial records, falsification of business records under Minnesota law, can be tied to an election-related conspiracy.
Under New York law.
Yes, this is a state court charge here. And so, you know, this falsification of business records in and of itself under the law is a misdemeanor unless prosecutors can prove the defendant acted with an intent to commit another crime, which in this case, if they can, it's elevated into a Class E felony. So the argument that the government's making here is that the former president sent a lot of money to his then lawyer, Michael Cohen, as reimbursement for paying off people that were allegedly involved in affairs with the former president. And the money was paid in installments and then allegedly falsely recorded in the Trump Organization's internal documents as a legal retainer. And so what the argument is that this is an overall scheme to violate federal and state election law. So they're characterizing this as, you know, a election subversion case. And so, you know, the argument is that the amount of these payments to the at least one of the women exceeded federal campaign contribution limits. Payments allegedly violated state election laws because they aimed to influence the 2016 election through unlawful means. And the payments to Cohen violated state tax laws because he was paid more than the amount of money he was due to be reimbursed to compensate him for having to pay taxes on the money. So it's a doozy of a case, Rich. Again, I'm not good to say anything regarding this on the merits. I will only say that I think it was noteworthy that the federal government chose not to prosecute the former president directly for these alleged campaign violations related to these alleged hush money payoffs. And you might remember that a former presidential candidate, John Edwards, was charged and was tried for similar conduct, and I believe he was acquitted. And so the question here ultimately is, you know, if these payments were made, if the government can prove that, were they made at the direction of the former president, was this, you know, Mr. Cohen acting independently as a quote fixer to take care of this,
right?
And was the purpose of these payments to protect the former president from, you know, disclosure of embarrassing personal revelations, or was this an effort to subvert the election?
Yeah,
and so, you know, I think the media perhaps does a disservice to the charge, or the maybe legal commentators, not just the media, by referring it to a hush money case.
Yeah.
I mean, payment of hush money isn't necessarily illegal or inappropriate.
Right. This was my question about this case, is if he, okay, so he paid her money to keep her mouth shut. That's not illegal. There's, you know, there's morality involved there, but it's not illegal.
It only becomes illegal, according to the government, is if you are falsifying records related to that payment and you're characterizing those payments in your internal business documents as something that it wasn't. And the purpose for that was to avoid potential violations of state law and federal election and tax laws. Now, I think the critics of the prosecution have said, boy, that's leveraging a lot there. I mean, you've got a, you know, business matter, basically the argument, who's harmed by that? Mm-hmm. I mean, that kind of the, you know, this was an internal issue. Others say, hold it, at the time that these payments were made, You know, the 2016 election was, you know, not determined yet. Yep. It hadn't occurred. Yep. And so could this have had an effect on that? I don't know. Again,
nobody knows.
No, you don't. And you know, Mr. Cohen, must be said, admitted in 2018, he was prosecuted federally for breaking campaign finance laws and in the arranging of these payments. And he was also convicted of lying to Congress. And so, you know, when your star witness is somebody who has felony convictions on their record for, you know, not telling the truth,
right.
I mean, that makes the case harder to prove. On the other hand, Cohen is not the only witness that's going to step forward here.
Right.
And so stay tuned. It could be must-see. Well, it won't be must-see TV because it's not televised, probably mercifully, frankly. We don't need that right now.
I can't imagine footage of Stormy Daniels on the testifying.
Justice Mershon, the judge who's handling this case, you've got to give him a lot of credit for patience because this case has involved countless motions to try to delay it, stall it, throw it out. A lot of work, and then just the management of the logistics of a trial in Manhattan of this nature. And this is the first time, I believe, that a former president has gone to trial on something
indeed.
Like this.
On criminal.
And so it's really an extraordinary day in the United States legal history.
It is.
And, you know, I think there are many, many who are kind of questioning why this was the first case of the various Trump charges to go to trial. And, you know, it's just related to where these cases are at. So, Alvin Bragg, the Manhattan DA, is, you know, I mean, you talk about a prosecution that kind of you're staking your career on to some degree here. Generally speaking, I think former governor and presidential candidate Chris Christie has said it many times, if you're going to take a shot at somebody this important and this powerful, you need to have an airtight case. And I think most objective people looking at this would say this is not an airtight case for the prosecution.
Yeah.
Because when you're turning a misdemeanor into a felony based upon federal laws that the president isn't charged with committing, it's worth noting that this Trump has not been charged with any other crimes in the case other than falsifying business records for his organization. And, you know, I think they're going to introduce evidence that he maybe signed checks, but the actual business record work was being done by, you know, internal people in the organization. So, yeah, stay tuned on this one, Rich. This is going to be an interesting one. It may be finished by the time that we are back on the radio in May.
Yeah.
It may be, but it could take a week and a half to pick a jury here.
I think
there were like 1,000 people summoned to potentially be a juror here. And you know, who wouldn't have heard about this or have some thought about it?
Yeah, I would think jury selection is going to be, I mean, it's going to be very, very detailed.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, we obviously it has nothing to do with anything that my court's being involved with, thank goodness.
Yes.
But we can thank our lucky stars for that. But it's I think every citizen that's paying attention should be thinking about things like this and looking at this, particularly with an election coming up.
All right. Yeah. One last quick question. We've only got a few minutes left, but today is, of course, April 15th. And we got to pay our taxes today, Your Honor. And give me just a couple of minutes on you know, the people out there are thinking, I'm going to let that go this year. I mean, what happens if you don't pay your taxes?
Well, a lot of, you know, a lot of bad things can happen civilly and criminally. Remember, there are two revenue collection authorities. There's the IRS and the State Department of Revenue. And one way or another, it's generally going to come around to haunt you because what will be created is a tax lien that could be applied to a lot of things in the future or could prevent you from potentially obtaining certain types of government benefits, certain types of, you know, potentially, you know, financial loans and things that have federal and state components to it. And in, you know, serious cases, it'll subject you to potential audits. And if you have to repay, if you're found to have violated willfully, you know, they could result in a potential criminal prosecution. Now, those cases, you know, for the average person are probably few and far between, but penalties and interest can be significant on unpaid taxes. And I, you know, I think from what I've heard over the years, the authorities are pretty lenient with giving people extensions if they're requested, mm-hmm. and working with people that are making a good faith effort mm-hmm. to do what they're doing. But it is, yeah, a very, very ill-advised idea to assume that nobody's going to notice.
Because I think,
generally speaking, in life, at some point in time when you least expect it, it's going to get noticed.
They're going to figure it out. Yeah.
It's one of those civic obligations that we all have to deal with. And and we don't get the extension this year. During the COVID period, they give us a little bit of an extension to file, which I don't think exists
this year.
They did.
And now last year I had to file for an extension because I got a late jump on what I was doing. And it turns out my taxes were very complicated last year. My understanding is that you file for that extension, you'll get it. And you've got until midnight tonight to file for that extension.
Yeah, my understanding is you do need to file the request for an extension
you do.
On time.
The other thing, though, is that if you owe money on that extension, that money is still due today.
Yes.
So if you think you're going to owe money and you're filing for an extension, you still need to write the IRS or you need to write a check. And, you know, at least estimate what you're going to, because they will charge you interest and penalties on that. Even if you get your taxes done in July.
Right.
Yeah. So folks, get on top of it if you haven't already.
Yeah. There's lots of, obviously there's a lot of online tools that are out there that can help people work their way through taxing, but yeah, it's important, Rich. I mean, if we have a society where a certain percentage of the people just choose, not to pay their fair share or not to pay their taxes, what do we have? I mean,
exactly.
Nobody likes, paying taxes to the government.
No.
Who creates, new intersections of state highways and interstates, like having out on Highway 19 and 35, the work that's gone on in the city of Northfield and Dundas for various municipal improvements. I mean, somebody has to pay for that.
Yes.
And we do through our taxes. Now, there's different types of taxes. Obviously, there's sales taxes and excise taxes for visitors to the community and things like that. But, we have to pay our income taxes, and we need to do that ethically and honestly. And I just take the attitude that, if you're choosing to cut corners in life, at some point in time, that's going to catch up with you.
It will catch up
with you. Whether it's, going too fast on the interstate, whether it's, skipping your taxes. And the problem that I've heard from people that I know that I've had in court before that have gotten down into the rabbit hole of not paying their taxes is it just mushrooms. And then, one year becomes another year, and then it's just in the too hard category, and people kind of just, give up. And that's not, I think the authorities would rather work with people mm-hmm. than, subject them to other types of sanctions. But you've got, like you said, you've got to be proactive and ask for help, ask for an extension, and, make a good faith effort to get your taxes filed.
Right. I just look at it as taxes are the price we pay to live in a democracy.
Yeah,
we
do. And, it's tax policy is obviously a major contended policy issue that is debated by the parties. You mm-hmm. know, certain types of taxes are more regressive, meaning that, they affect people with less income in a more, onerous way.
Mm-hmm.
There's property taxes, obviously the city and county and, various school taxing authorities. We have to, levies are paid through property taxes. Income taxes are part of, as you say, the price of living in a country like ours.
Yes, exactly right.
And so, this is a topic that we could spend a lot of time on, but I would strongly recommend that, people do their civic duty and not be subject to penalties, interest, and the worst thing, potentially a charge.
Listen to the man. This is a member of the Minnesota State Supreme Court. He knows what he's talking about, folks. Get your taxes in. Yeah. Justice Moore, these conversations always go way too fast, and we always appreciate the time you give us for these things.
Pleasure to be here, Rich. Good to see everybody, and as I told you, my anniversary is today.
That's right.
Jane and I got married on tax day, so and it's helpful to never forget either anniversaries or paying taxes. So happy anniversary to my long-suffering spouse who's supported me through a long, long time of 35 years, I believe.
Who is an absolutely remarkable woman in her own right as well, too.
She's an amazing person. Yes, she is. Involved in a lot of things in Northfield, an outstanding writer and musician and just overall, good person. And unfortunately, when your anniversary is on Monday and it's tax day, it's kind of hard to get, sort of real fired up about it. But yeah, we'll do something.
I hope you got a little time to celebrate over the weekend.
Maybe. Yeah, we did. We had a couple of nice opportunities for that. So
that's good.
All right. So we'll see you in May.
Yeah. Folks, Justice Moore will be back third Monday of May, as he is every month. And until then, thank you for listening to Legal Talk.
This has been Legal Talk with Minnesota Supreme Court Associate Justice Gordon Moore. If you have questions for Justice Moore or would like to suggest a topic for future conversations, email us at contact@kymnradio.net.